From Pages of the Moon.
And I'm Laura from Laura Liz Buckley.
And welcome to a extra special book club episode. This month we discussed paranormal / witchy / books with magic. And I say all of that because some of the books sort of teetered on some of those themes. We'll get more into that later. So this is July's book club episode. What did you read this week, Laura?
I read Sweet and Bitter Magic by Adrian Tooley.
Ooh. I read Spells Trouble by PC Cast and Kristen Cast.
Very exciting.
Very exciting. So if you're new to our podcast, firstly, welcome. Thank you so much for listening to us. The general setup for this week's episode is going to be I'm going to give the blurb of my book and then Laura's going to read the blurb of hers. Then I'm going to take it away by giving you my pitch, my thoughts and feelings, my roundup / seashell rating and the all important question before I hand over to Laura, and then we'll answer any questions given to us by our lovely, amazing book club members. So, without further ado, I'm going to kick straight off with Spells Trouble's blurb.
Woohoo!
Hunter and Mercy Good are twin witches, direct descendants of the founder of their town of Goodville. As their ancestors have done before them, it is now time for the twins to learn what it means to be gatekeepers, the protectors of the gates of the different underworlds, ancient portals between their world and realms where mythology, rules and nightmares come to life. When their mother becomes the first victim in a string of murders, the devastated sisters vow to avenge her death. But it will take more than magic to rein in the ancient mythological monsters who've infected their peaceful town. Now Hunter and Mercy must come together and accept their destiny or risk being separated for good.
Well, that sounds very interesting and quite intense.
Does. What about your blurb?
Okay. Sweet and Bitter Magic's blurb. Tamsin is the most powerful witch of her generation, but after committing the worst magical sin, she's exiled by the ruling coven and cursed with the inability to love. The only way she can get those feelings back, even for just a little while, is to steal love from others. Ren is a source, a rare kind of person who is made of magic, despite being unable to use it herself. Sources are required to train with the coven as soon as they discover their abilities, but Ren, the only caretaker to her ailing father, has spent her life hiding her secret. When a magical plague ravages the queendom, Ren's father falls victim. To save him, Ren proposes a bargain. If Tamsin will help her catch the Dark Witch responsible for creating the plague, then Ren will give Tamsin her love for her father. Of course, love bargains are a tricky thing, and these two have a long, perilous journey ahead of them. That is, if they don't kill each other first.
Ooh.
But, I mean, before we can get into that, I'm going to need to hear more about your book. So, are you ready to pitch it?
I am. My pitch isn't all that much different from the original blurb, but I will explain as to why as we go on. Twin sisters Hunter and Mercy are like any other teenagers. They experience the highs and lows of high school, with one wanting to just survive and the other boy crazy. The only difference to their school friends is that they're witches, and when they discover ancient portals they need to protect and to avenge someone dear to them, the two will have to work closer than ever or risk their world imploding.
Okay, short and sweet.
So I took it back to basics for my pitch because I felt like the blurb was trying so hard to be so many different things. And it was very intriguing, the blurb, but I don't feel like it was very true to what the book actually ended up being, which was something that a lot of the other book club members sort of expressed as well. But I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but that's why I really stripped back the pitch because I actually do feel like the pitch is a little bit more applicable to the book that I read.
Okay.
Normally I don't obviously sing my own song about how good my pitch is, but I actually do feel like I've nailed it for this week.
Nice one.
To gain a bit of insight into the book, it's told from each sister's point of view and it's all in third person. So we first meet Hunter, who is swimming by the side of this lake, and there's some boys quite far out, and she's having a good time by herself. She's waiting for her friend to show up, and she hears the boys laughing at her, so she's a bit like immediately flustered. She panics, she tries to get back to the beach, and this sort of alludes to that she's been bullied, she's not had a great experience during high school, And because of that, she just goes back to the shore and tries to ignore them the best they can until one of her and her sister's friend turns up and they sort of like purposely flirt with the boys even across the water. Hunter is quieter than her sister. She also, although I don't know how well executed this was, but she's queer. It is brought up in the book, but it's more brought up in showing how Hunter struggled through her high school experience. Mm-hmm. And there are slurs mentioned, so I feel like I should point that out just because I think it was very clumsily handled and there was no sort of build up to it. So I just want to make that distinction right before we get into it. Eventually, Mercy shows up. Mercy has a boyfriend. Boyfriend's pretty, seems a bit harmless, a bit dopey, literally a teenage boyfriend, basically. And they end up having sort of this party for their birthday, like at the beach. Now, Mercy, we get the distinct feeling Mercy's quite popular. She has a lot of friends. She's very good at socializing, whereas Hunter isn't. And this is where the distinctions start to begin for the twins. So we can sort of like make them out to be who each person is. I feel like it's very thin and not very well explored. The distinctions that we get are more told to us than sort of like things that we experience or that we feel as we're reading the book. It is literally, how can we make these two females completely different? Oh, here's a cheat sheet. Let's tick them off and let's give them to each one. I wish this was my only problem with the book, but unfortunately it isn't. I'm trying to be as respectful as I can because, you know, sometimes books aren't just for me, but also there are a lot of things that I felt when I read this book, things that I don't think were well executed, and I'm not going to shy away from that. Normally I try and skirt around and try and find a positive, but I think this is the first book that I've read on the podcast that I really, really haven't enjoyed to this degree. So I feel like it's only fair for me to be honest. Mm-hmm. I am sweating profusely from the fact that I'm having to be this honest. So just bear that in mind. When, if this is like your favourite book and you come for me, this is very hard for me. It's not an easy thing. So basically they're at the beach. We get some interaction between the two sisters. There's some friction and there's a lot of friction between Hunter and Mercy's boyfriend. We don't really understand why. I don't know if it's protectiveness or the fact that she just thinks he's a bit of a dick. It's a bit hard to differentiate at this point. Their friend is just a lot. So they both have a best friend each, which is very, very stereotypical. So Hunter's best friend is a boy. He's very understanding, very caring, very empathetic. He brings a present for Hunter. He even does something quite nice for Mercy as well, to which Mercy's like, to her girl best friend, oh, you best like wipe the floor of her friend. Like, you've got to be the top best friend, which puts a lot of pressure on Mercy's friend. But also, Mercy's friend is a lot, like she's dialed up to 150%. Take the cheerleading main character from any 2000s TV show and like dial her up a lot and give her a Red Bull, and that is Mercy's best friend.
Okay.
But she was fun. She brought a little bit of light humour in at occasion. So it wasn't uber terrible, but yeah. Basically, as most witchy things go about, the two sisters have to leave by a certain time to meet their mum so that they can do their birthday ritual because they're turning 16. And obviously this is when they begin to be inducted into the whole protecting the underworld / ancient portals situation. I won't go through all of the bits of the plot, but basically they have to pick like a sort of like a magic thread to support and claim as that like their goddess, but there is gods as well. Mm-hmm. Hunter picks a god and Mercy has some feelings on this, which are later explored in the latter half of the book, so I won't really go into that, but she's upset about it. And Mercy picks a goddess and they're both very happy. It's very true to who they are. It's sort of like along the lines of whether you're like a kitchen witch, etc., etc. It's sort of like that sort of thread. Mm-hmm. It's what you're going to specialize in sort of thing. And then mum's like going through the whole like, this is what, you know, you need to do and stuff. And then her mum gets attacked. Now, her mum dies very early on. She is killed by a large wolf. And it begins like a series of events that goes off. And this is where the book really takes a bit of a deep dive into no plot expansion from that point. Not a lot happens. Things are very clumsily done. Things are done without very much explanation or reaction after that. The sisters from the get-go aren't super believable anyway, and the writing for them is rarely progressive. It leads to them being very difficult to root for several times, not because they do technically bad things and you think, oh, you know, they could just be flawed, but rather that they're just really stagnant. And it gets intensified after their mum dies, because one sister, Mercy, is really, really struggling with the fact that their mum's died. And the best way that Hunter can think of fixing this is to magic away her grief. And we don't get any further expansion into that. Mercy's just okay with the fact that her sister's done this to her. And that's just one of the small, like, tiny things that really bothered me. The other thing is that I'm really here for sex positive teens in fiction. I think it's definitely needed. And I think especially, I don't know what it's like in America, and I don't know what it's obviously like in other countries, but in England, we do have sex education, but it's very, very clinical, I would say. It's not really about anything else. It's not about how to prepare. It's not about exploring how you feel about those sort of things. It is very, very clinical. So I always think it's really important in books to tackle that, because I think that's where people can really learn about when they should feel ready more than, you know, anything else. However, Mercy sort of doesn't want to have sex, and she doesn't have sex, I will say that, but she ends up performing a sex act on her boyfriend straight after her mum's died. Now, obviously, there are times when people do react out when they've lost a parent, and I completely empathise with that, but it's very, I don't think it was handled very well. I think it sort of happened and then it was brushed under the carpet, and she never made any sort of notion to repeat this event after it, which you would think if she was going right off, you know, the deep end, it'd be something that she constantly craves, to feel something, to feel alive in a sense, or to, you know, to not feel grief. However, it only happens once, and it's very explicit. It's at least a page and a half, if not more. And it's a lot. It's very, very intense. But the other thing that rattled me and more about this is that Mercy's the one that's struggling the most, and it doesn't feel like Mercy's the one that's the most connected to her mum. It feels like Hunter is, because Mercy, for the point that her mum's alive, calls her by her first name and not mum. Now, if this was like a distinction, like it's a very witchy thing to do, you'd expect Hunter to do the same, but Hunter still calls her mum. So it's very, very baffling. And it sort of provides a really odd vibe to the beginning of the book, because it doesn't expand on why. The other thing that annoys me slightly about Mercy's character is that she curses in British English, but the book is set in America.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was an interesting choice. Grief is handled poorly again later on in the book. I won't like say why it's handled poorly, because if you do want to read it and if it's something you've been eyeing up, another event happens, obviously, as the blurb said, there's a lot of murder that's going to happen. So there are, unfortunately, people who are going to be grieving. But that grief is also handled very poorly throughout. So I wouldn't say it's just handled poorly between Hunter and Mercy. It's handled very poorly throughout the book. It's like it's almost as if the authors believe that teenagers don't feel that grief, whereas actually I think it would be felt more prominently, because your emotions are already all over the place. So you're going to feel it, if not more. There's no practicality, I think, when you're a teenager. Like, if your world falls apart, your world has fallen apart. Like, you don't have to get up and go to work and pay for your mortgage. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
The other thing that sort of began grating on me, and I think it grated on a lot of the other book club members, was that the writing didn't feel strong enough to be a young adult book, even though it had a lot of themes that are tackled in young adult, as well as some themes that I really think should be in new adult. I'm not just talking about the explicit sex act scene, but also just the communication when the mum was alive. There is like a small chunk where her mum decides to stop talking about female pleasure, which again I'm all here for, but it definitely came out of the blue in the context of the writing style, because the writing felt very middle grade at times. This obviously is in a juxtaposition to the fact that the language slurs and sexual nature to the book makes it really impossible for it to be correctly placed in a young adult category. And I don't have children, but if my child picked this up, because young adult is obviously, it covers a lot of age, the younger part of young adult as well, if my child was that age and picked this book up, I would be absolutely shocked that they would be getting a page and a half sex scene. The plot almost reads as if it's too big for these authors, and it falls flat in several points throughout the book, to the point that I would have very easily been able to put this book down and never felt any sort of interest to pick it back up, which is really sad. I mainly did it because I continued the book because I wanted to discuss it, obviously, here, but also because I had chosen this book for the book club and I felt some kind of way about just going and not having read the book and, you know, not knowing how it ended. But it was handled very, very poorly. The pacing is really slow and it's almost painful at times, and there's actually very little progression when you pick the book apart. And by chapter 4, I'd become tired of either sister very, very quickly and found very little to grasp onto about any redeeming parts of them. The other thing that I felt was really difficult and it didn't grab me as much was that there was a lot of telling, which hampered any development or personal connection, and it created a lot of disconnect between the reader and the characters. Especially when the mum died, I felt like this would have been a really interesting point to try and hook us back in and sort of change the tone of the book by giving us an insight into how either of the sisters were feeling about this. However, we had a brief moment of either sister sort of falling apart, but then their familiar became a human, even though she's a cat, and then proceeded to walk around and call everyone kitten all the time, which was just an odd vibe. She also hissed at people, which I don't exactly dislike, because, you know, I kind of like that the familiar is, there's still that element of the familiar there. However, it was odd. And in the context of everything else that was going off, I don't think it was a thread that needed to be there. I know that the two sisters needed more guidance because they'd lost their guidance, because it did feel like they didn't know a lot about what was going off. And these are two people that should have been training for this position their entire life up until this point. They've had 16 years and it doesn't seem like they know a lot. The other thing is, when we do get any sort of bit of magic, it's not the magic that I expected from the blurb. It's very, let's throw a bit of sage on the situation. And as somebody who loves paranormal and witch books in particular, I found this the most disheartening part of the entire book, because I expected a bit more pizzazz, especially from the blurb. The blurb sounded phenomenal. It really gave a different idea of magic than I've read up to this point. And I felt immensely let down by the fact that it wasn't explored, like what the book said it was going to do, it didn't do. And if it was doing that, it was done so poorly that I didn't recognise either of those things. The surrounding cast are very unlikable. I know I've touched on the two friends, but there are a sea of other people that float in and float out, and they're all the worst. So there's not even like a character that you can sort of cling to. Everyone feels very 90s. It feels very outdated. I don't know exactly what year it's meant to be set in. It's not very clear from the book. There's very little that you can gauge on about the town. It's very two-dimensional, so it's very hard. But maybe wrongly on my part, I just assumed it was now because it didn't make any clear distinction that it wasn't. But everyone felt very 90s. And if everyone had come out and talked about, you know, something that was related to that time period, that wouldn't have surprised me, because it did feel like, you know, your Buffy times, your One Tree Hill. It just felt very animated and people weren't really being themselves. The use of language also between the teenagers just provided an even deeper sense of disconnection. Like, I'm not a teenager, I'm late 20s. Oh God, I'm almost 30 now. Woo. But even for me, I read a lot of young adult and I was like, teenagers don't talk like this. Like, teenagers don't do these things. And it was actually somebody in the book club who told me that. So PC Cass and Kristen Cass are a mother-daughter duo who have written this book. And it was the mother who's written it and the daughter who's edited it. I'm not sure if that dynamic is completely working for them. I know they're very successful, but there are definitely a big disconnect now between if the mother's going to continue to write. She's not got a good grasp on what teenagers are currently talking like. Especially, I'm not American, and even I know that American teenagers don't currently talk like this, and I'm British. There are a few things that I did like. I did like the prologue. So there was a beginning chapter that was really interesting. It was amazing, actually. It was really enjoyable to read, and I kind of hoped the rest of the book would continue in that fashion. However, it didn't. The prologue also gave us a backstory about the Good family, but it was never slid back into the book. So it was literally there, like they'd written it, didn't want to get rid of it, so called it a prologue. Like I said, Hunter is queer, but again, you only know this because she's bullied, so I'm not really sure if I do love it or not, but I just feel like it's nice that the representation was there, but also it feels like a bit of a token representation. It's meant to just make me feel a little bit better, and it didn't, but I didn't know where to put it because I didn't hate it.
Sure.
So I'm just mentioning this section because I'm trying to find some positives to cling on to. As I said, I really loved the premise. I really loved the idea, and I think it had a lot of promise if it was executed properly. I'm going to be savage because I didn't want to start this podcast with my best friend and then lie about how I felt. I am a little bit... When I was reading this book, the thing that bothered me the most was that there are big red flags that should have been picked up at multiple points. Regardless of whether your daughter's editing it, there's got to be somebody else editing it. There are huge moments where the book just... Nothing is happening. A whole chapter sometimes... When nothing is happening, there is an entire 3-page conversation between the two sisters where they're telling us as the reader what is happening instead of showing us. And I'm a writer and I know that's a big no-no and that should have been picked up. And the thing is, it wasn't buried amongst loads of other chapters. It was so early on that it put my back up quite a lot as a writer because I'm trying my hardest to get my manuscript as good as it can be to maybe even not ever get representation. And then this book has been published. And I know that sounds really harsh, and it is harsh, and it's a lot coming from somebody who hasn't even been published. But as I read this book, if I could have annotated it, because I read it on Kindle, and I know you can highlight it, but it would have become very tiresome if I highlighted all the flat points. There were more flat points than there were high points in this book. And it became very boring to read. Mm. I know that's a big word to say about a book. I went back and I read a lot of the Goodreads reviews, and a lot of people felt the same. So I'm hoping that because this book is part of a series, the authors will reflect and learn from some of the constructive criticism about this first part and hopefully correct some of them in the later books. But if it was me, I'd want to take that book back, re-edit it and re-upload it, because I think they could do better. I think they really could. They're experienced. They clearly know what they're doing. They've come up with a very interesting premise. It's just taking that time to make sure that it's executed properly. And unfortunately, it just wasn't. I will pretty much read anything with witches in it. I mean, I very recently went back and read The Worst Witch because it was one of my favourite books as a kid. And it's a middle grade book and I still thoroughly loved it. So it doesn't matter what age group it is. If it's got witches in it, I'll read it. But I don't like this book. And when it comes to my seashell rating, it's painful for me to even give this out. But it's a 1 seashell. Oof. Out of 5. It's a book. It's a book that I read. I would have very happily DNF'd it if I didn't feel like I had to read it for the book club. I know that Laura would have been very understanding about all the things that I've said about me DNFing it for the podcast, but I couldn't do that to the book club, not when everyone else had read it. So I continued on. And yeah, it was just very clumsy. It was slow and it was just really, really frustrating. And the one last thing I realise I haven't mentioned is the Doors to the Underworld seem oddly chosen. Now I say this and I'm white and I'm British, but the underworld doors are Greek, Norse, Japanese and Hindu, as well as Egyptian. All of these portals are in the middle of Illinois, protected by white females. I'm not going to expand further on that. I don't think that was the best choice, but I didn't write the book. But again, that's just something just to throw out, because I don't think token representation is doing bits right now.
Not ideal.
Not ideal. No. I don't want to say too much because it's not my place. But I will say that I don't think it was handled very well. It sort of just slotted in there. There was no expansion on it. So 1 seashell for me out of 5 lovely seashells.
I feel like I know the answer to this question, but, you know, it's the nature of the podcast that I have to ask. Would you take Spells Travel to the Island Library?
Yes. No, I wouldn't. No.
Go figure.
I want to be proven wrong, though. I want the rest of the series to try and prove me wrong. So...
Will you be reading book 2?
I'm going to see what the reviews say.
Mm-hmm.
If the reviews change and the authors have taken on board some of the criticism, I feel like it's unfair of me to then continue to call them out and not read their next bit. But if the reviews continue to be the same as they are for the first book, I don't think so.
Fair enough.
Thank you very much for your time. Sorry for...
So, I mean, yeah, interesting book. Which brings us on to the magical witchy book that I read, Sweet and Bitter Magic.
Woo woo!
So, my pitch, Tamsin, cursed never to feel love, gets by fixing problems for people in the nearby village, for a strange fee. It's a waste of her enormous magical talent, but it's all that's left to her since she was exiled by the coven. At least until a cursed plague starts to sweep the land and Ren shows up on her doorstep. The plague has put her father at risk and she's prepared to do anything to save him. Even team up with a witch, even if the price is her love for her father.
Aww.
So I kind of wanted to... Again, obviously my pitch doesn't reference the fact that Ren is a source, which is kind of a big deal, but I wanted to put her self-sacrificing nature at the fore because that, I think, is kind of a pretty core character trait. And it's almost kind of more integral to her character than her power, although her power was one of the things that was really cool about the book. So I felt bad leaving it out. Sweet and Bitter Magic was a really easy read. It was fun. It was fine. It didn't blow me away. It wasn't... I feel like I need to emphasise this after talking about Still Troll. It wasn't bad. It just wasn't, I think, fulfilling its own potential. So you've got two point of view protagonists, Tamsin and Ren, and they're kind of archetypal opposites. You've got Tamsin, who's the cynical, self-interested one, and Ren, who's the sweet, open-hearted one. And so it's kind of like a opposites attract, buddy adventure, except they're not buddies. I've heard it described as like an enemies to lovers romance. I think... For me, an enemies to lovers romance, there should be a lot more focus on how much they don't like each other and how that unravels over the course of the story. So I wouldn't necessarily call it that, although it shares some of the hallmarks of enemies to lovers. It's more like it's antagonistic to lovers, I guess.
That's fair. A new category.
They're not the deepest characters. They're interesting, but they don't seem to have massive layers to them. They've each kind of got one complicating factor. I think it was better handled in Tamsin than Ren. So Tamsin has her curse, which strips her of the ability to feel love. So it's not just romantic love. She can't love anyone or anything. So it's described a lot more at the beginning, and then you kind of don't get quite as many references to it, probably because it would have got a bit old. She can't kind of see the beautiful colours that she would have seen before. So sunsets look really drab and grey. Tastes that she used to love just taste really bland. So it's a pretty grim way to live. I think there were moments where I thought it was handled in a really interesting way, and moments where I thought, does that make sense if she doesn't feel love? I don't know. Well, never mind. So one thing is, I don't even remember the specific moment, so I can't spoil it, luckily. But she kind of has a moment where she thinks she got so used to thinking that sorrow or something, some emotion, was only possible because if you felt love. But, oh, look, she's feeling really sad or angry or whatever it was. And the kind of way that the author handled some of those moments I thought was really interesting and made for a nice spin on a character who you get a lot of these kind of cold exterior, heart of gold. And I thought the way that Tamsin played with that stereotype was fun. For Ren, her kind of complicating layer is her family situation. Her mother is dead, I believe. So she just lives with her dad. She did have a younger sibling who died in a way related to magic, and it left both of her parents really deeply suspicious and fearful of magic. So as a result, she's never told her father that she is a source. Being a source means that she can sense and see magic in a way that most people can't, even witches can't. She can't use magic herself, but she can supply it. So magic in this book does have a cost. The magic system isn't massively explored, but that's kind of not what the book's going for. World building is not a high priority for it. But magic does have a cost in the form of kind of a physical toll that it takes to use it. And witches of different powers experience that cost differently. So a very weak witch might do a spell and be bedridden for a day, whereas a much more powerful witch, like Tamsin is, might do the same spell and just feel a little bit achy, but be otherwise fine. But using a source, pairing up with a source, means that you can kind of draw magic from them and the physical consequences are much less than they would otherwise be.
Hmm, interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was quite a nice mechanism that was established. So, yeah, back to Ren's family situation. She's never told anybody that she has this power. I'm not quite sure how she discovered it without somebody telling her. So I don't know if it's just such common knowledge that she kind of could recognise, oh, I can see that. That's not something that other people can see. I'm seeing magic, so I must be a source. Or whether there was some moment where she was talking about being able to see magic and other people were like, that sounds like you're seeing magic. And she was like, oh no, I better not tell anybody about this because my parents hate magic. Like, I would have liked to know how she discovered it, particularly since she's been hiding it and that's been a massive feature. Like, how does she know to hide it if nobody told her what it... I don't know. Maybe this was just me getting hung up on some small detail that didn't matter, but it did bug me. So there's that. Her dad is painted, I think, as really emotionally manipulative.
Oh no.
He's unwell in this sort of vague way. We don't know whether it's kind of an emotional kind of mental health issue or whether there's a physical component to it. He doesn't seem to be able to look after himself at all. But he tells Ren all the time that he would die if she left. He can't live without her. He would literally be useless. There's also, she feels like she can't cut her hair. She's got this like long red hair. She feels like she can't cut it even though she wants to because her dad's always like looking at it mournfully and telling her how much it looks just like her mum's. So she feels this pull to go out and explore the world, but she feels trapped by her father and her father's need for her. And she kind of resents that even though she loves him and doesn't and wants to take care of him. But reading it, it definitely feels like it feels like he's manipulating her.
Yeah.
And there's even a conversation between Ren and Tamsin, which I'll come back to in a moment anyway, because the kind of way that their conversations played out over the course of the book was a bit odd to me. But where Tamsin is kind of saying, acknowledging in her narration, that it sounds like her dad's kind of just using her and wants her to believe that she's necessary so that he doesn't lose that kind of crutch. And while all of this was getting set up, I was really intrigued and I thought, you know, this is going to be really strong material for a great character arc for Ren. This is going to be some really compelling stuff to unpack as she kind of comes into her own and decides how much is she still prepared to give to the world and how much is she going to keep back for herself and how is she going to learn to protect herself from people who are trying to use her and take advantage of her. And I just didn't feel like any of that paid off.
It's just there. Just
yeah.
There.
Now, there was character development. Both of the characters do kind of grow and change. But the character development felt pretty flat. It felt very one note. Like, oh, they were like this. But now at the end, they are more like this. Rather than an arc that you really saw play out in moments where they became more confident or more kind of self-aware or more determined to do A or B. So, yeah, there was character growth. I felt like the setup was not matched by the payoff. And that was kind of a running theme in this book. Things that were set up, moments that were either hinted at or begun, that kind of were never as big a deal as you would have hoped they would be. And the actual way that things turned out, in terms of any of these particular moments that were set up or any of these arcs or themes that were set up, they were fine. But the setup made you think, ooh, this could be really exciting. And then it would be like, oh no, it's just okay. So it was this really weird experience of being constantly slightly underwhelmed, but also feeling like, I mean, I can't really fault what they did.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
The author did something. The author's result here is serviceable and entertaining, but it could have been fascinating.
Yeah.
The world building, as mentioned, was a little bit thin, but for the most part, that was fine. It's a standalone book. It's not a massive book. It's not going for a deep, rich fantasy world. So you kind of get the world that you are introduced to at the start, where Tamsin is living and where Ren is living. it's very kind of standard Eurocentric fairy tale-esque fantasy. So, you know, your little villages and your local witch that everyone's a little bit suspicious of, but they bring their sick babies to her and, you know, it's all...
She heals all!
Very standard fairy tale witchy fair.
Yeah.
There were things that I would have liked to understand a bit better about the world. So the moment where the news kind of arrives that there's this plague spreading, I felt like I wasn't really sure what level of stakes we were talking about, what kind of risk. There's a sense that kind of people have either left the village or gone into hiding. And I'm like, where have they gone? Are they hiding in their houses because it's not safe to come out? Or have they gone somewhere else? What's the distance between where this plague has started and where we are now? How imminent is the threat? It feels like the news arrives and suddenly everybody's gone. I'm like, did they just evacuate immediately? Have they hidden in the basements? Are they expecting the plague to arrive today? Or is this is coming in the next few weeks? How big is the land?
Yeah.
How populated is it? Is this like millions of people are dying, or is this... it's coming through these tiny little villages. I don't know. It doesn't matter. It didn't hinder my enjoyment of the book. But definitely the chapter where it feels like the plague is imminent, I'm like, how imminent is imminent? Do we need to be getting out of here now? Should I be afraid for Ren in this moment, standing here in the village square? Or is it we need to get ready?
The other thing is it's the other things, isn't it? It like provides those questions of going as well. Like, so how much food do we all need to be like, oh, you're gonna bunk, like, is this plague gonna, does it sit around for a while, or does it just like fade like mist?
Maybe this is partly as well coming out of a pandemic. I'm like, you know, where's all the toilet paper?
Do you know what
are
I mean?
We holed up with cans of beans, or are we hoping that this loaf of bread is gonna last us? I just
is a 12 pack enough for a family of four, or do I need to get 36 like toilet rolls?
Yeah. So yeah, that was a minor bugbear for me. Where the lack of world building felt like a much bigger deal was when they got to the Witchlands, which was kind of had quite a lot of sort of build up to it. Ren has kind of always known that she should have gone there when she discovered her power, because sources are, it's kind of almost a legal obligation to go and be trained, but she didn't. And so she's really excited to go and see this place that she potentially should have been since childhood. And there's kind of a magical barrier scenario that they have to navigate, so it's set up as being very other, but there's really no sense of it being any different to the outside world. And given that Ren's powers as a source mean that she can see and smell magic, I was expecting there to be this amazing moment where she kind of arrives and the air is alive with magic, and, you know, get to see these snippets of how the construction of everything is different because witches are living here freely and using their powers. Or maybe it's overwhelming and she's inundated by all of the magic around her. But there was kind of, it was just like, oh, we went through this magic-y bit and now we're in more of the world. I was like, no, it's supposed to be different, surely.
Yes, surely it's meant to be more magical?
Yeah, I'd have thought. There's a cool thing where they go into a building and it's much bigger on the inside than it is on the outside.
Oh, you know, wild chestnut.
Love one of those.
Yeah.
But other than that, there's really nothing to differentiate the inside witch world from the outside regular world. And I felt like that was a bit of a missed opportunity, if I'm honest. Like so many things.
This episode.
I feel the need to reiterate, this is not a bad book.
Mine was.
Having said that, I do have another complaint, which is that there was quite a bit of telling rather than showing. Now, again, this might be partly because it's a standalone, felt like there was quite a lot of ground to cover, but there are a lot of kind of conversations between Ren and Tamsin that felt like it was telling us that they've had previous conversations and this is kind of a culmination conversation. And I'm like, why couldn't you just show us some of that? They've been on the road for days. Could we not have seen some of these other chats? Because I feel like the only stuff that we've seen is them not talking to each other because they annoy each other too much. But now suddenly they're having a conversation and you're telling me that they've had loads of these and therefore they've come to various conclusions about each other. Why couldn't I have seen any of that? Yeah. That's what I'm here for.
Yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
The relationship between them. Now, it is, I think, pretty clearly set up, marketed, discussed as a a romance. So I don't think I'm giving anything away by saying that there is a romance between these two. I did like it. I feel like we could have seen more of the development of it, but there are some really nice moments between them, and I liked them as a romance. And you got a sneaky little bit of there's only one bed trope, which I was not expecting to show up, but I was here for it.
Yep, always here for it.
Yes, it was one of those where I feel like I don't come across only one bed in the wild that much, partly because I don't read a lot of romance potentially, so yeah. It kind of is only when it sneaks into a fantasy book or something that I come across it. And I definitely had a sense of, we're in a room, only one bed. Okay.
How intriguing.
I see where we're going here. I mean, there's no graphic sex scene. Just again, I feel like having just talked about Spells Trouble, I need to clarify certain things. This is perfectly appropriate YA fare. But yeah, I don't know if there's anything, any other major points. The plot was fine. It was fun. I enjoyed it. There were things that were a bit predictable, didn't bother me. There were things that felt like a little bit of a stretch in terms of certain character motivations, but it was done well enough that I could go with it, even though I was a bit like, that feels like an odd direction for that character to have gone in. A couple of characters and moments that showed up feeling like they were going to be really significant, only to vanish into the ether immediately. One particularly cool character who was discussed, not massively extensively, but enough that you felt like, okay, well, they'll show up later. And then they did show up later, and it was like, ooh, what are they going to do? Turns out nothing. They're going to turn around and leave and never be referenced again.
Oh, no.
It was weird. But yeah, I did enjoy it. I read it very quickly. It kept me very engaged. And I don't have anything else to say about it. Nice book.
Nice book.
Nice book.
What's your seashell rating?
My seashell rating is a solid 3 shells.
Oh.
I liked it.
Would it be going with you to your island library?
Oh, bless it. It would not. No.
It tried, though. It tried.
It put up a good effort. It started really strong. It didn't really know what it was doing with its own, you know, building blocks, I think. But it put up a valiant effort. I would read more by this author.
Yeah. Was it their first book?
I don't think so. I think there's one other that I've seen referenced, which I believe came before this.
Right, okay. Do you feel like we've been on bad book dates? Not bad, but you went on an okay one. Like, it was nice. You had a nice meal, nice conversation, but you immediately knew it wasn't really going to...
There wasn't that spark. There wasn't chemistry between me and this book.
Whereas I just went on a really bad date.
You went on a date with a book who just talked about itself and told you about graphic sex stuff. And you were like, we've just met. I'm not here for this.
I've not even had my starter, bro.
Why are you telling me about a blowjob? You are really putting me off this soup.
Breadsticks just arrive and you're like, oh, I'm not going to have any of them now. That's what you get with this podcast, bad dates. Sometimes you get amazing dates. We've had some amazing dates.
We have had some amazing book dates.
Yeah. So we're going to finish off with some of the book club questions. So we had 2. Spells Trouble. How do you think the book could redeem itself in book 2 or book 3, because the book is going to be a trilogy?
That face said it all.
Okay, so I'm going to give 2 opinions. I'm going to give my writer's opinion and then my reading opinion. So my reading opinion is I think it really needs to spend a little bit of time, at least a couple of chapters, letting the two sisters take a minute, expand, grow, connect with us. I think there are definitely some moments that they need to reflect on, and I think that will provide some deeper connection with us as the reader. I think it might be worth explaining a little bit more about how the portal system works and why they're protecting them and why they're in Illinois. I think that'd be a really important part for us as the readers, just to get that expansion, just so that we understand. And then, I don't mean this to sound horrible, but in a trilogy, book 2 tends to be a bit fillery than normal, like connects the two big moments together. So I think it could really use that time to really grow and show the sisters growing from, you know, these 16-year-olds into people who are unfortunately now managing these portals and protecting them because their mum's died. I feel like they can process all of that, and I feel that'll be really, really good for the book, and then come back into book three a lot stronger, a lot more connected, and then we can fight alongside them. As a writer, I would pull this back. I'd pull book one back. I'd rework it. If you upload it back onto Kindle, I think it replaces the book that's already been purchased. I think it updates it, I think, from what I know. Or at least, you know, I don't know if you can let people go in and exchange the book again. I don't know. But I think there's a lot of missed opportunities and missed things that weren't explored with the care and, you know, the precision that he needed in book one, which means that I don't think a lot of people are actually going to go for book two, because it's like, well, if you can't handle it in the first one, are you going to be able to handle the big, big thing that's going to happen in book three? Mm. I would spend a little bit more time making the sisters more alike and having them differentiate on their opinions. There was a moment actually where Mercy had strong opinions about Hunter's pick of her picking a god. And I feel like that those little things can be what separates them and makes them each their own. They can have different inner voices. They don't think they need to be like polar opposite twins. I kind of don't like that trope anyway. Because, you know, yeah, you're going to be different. You're different people, but you're not going to be like exact polar opposites like all the time. Like, I feel like that's really hard. Like, especially even having a sibling. Me and my brother are very different, but there are a lot of things that we're very similar on. Like, we have very similar, like, humour, for example, and our mannerisms are very similar because we've grown up with each other. We're twins, you're with each other from the moment you're made.
Yeah.
So I find that quite hard to believe that these two people who are grown up in such a small household as well, it's just the mum and those two, that there's nothing else going off. So I think just building that twin relationship a little bit more, maybe making Mercy's friend a little bit less cray would be useful. And also like having Hunter's friend actually be present in the story and not just there just because you need an extra person every now and again would be nice. And that's probably the things I would just start them off with. Basically, just mainly like things to deepen the story before even thinking about executing the actual plot itself.
Fair enough.
I feel like that's what's missing. Savage.
Yeah. Well, I mean, no, I think you've been fair. I mean, I've not read it, obviously, but you've not trashed it. You've not said this is shit start to finish.
Yeah.
Nothing redeemable in there. You've picked out things that you thought were flawed, and there just happened to be a lot of them.
Yeah.
But that happens sometimes. The question for Sweet and Bitter Magic was, obviously, this book is a standalone, but if there was a book too, what would you want to see in it? I would want more development of Tamsin and Ren's relationship, because while I don't want to give away exactly where they end the book in terms of their relationship with each other, I think a lot of things about the ending felt like they'd been kind of tied up neatly because it was a standalone, and so the author didn't feel like they could leave any dangling threads or anything a little bit uncomfortable. But it feels like there are several elements of the book that could be further dug into and would make better use of the setup. So yeah, I would like to see Ren and Tamsin's relationship deepen, and maybe some of the friction between them that might have been a little bit glossed over to make for a satisfying ending, to a recognition of the fact that those things don't just disappear just because you've had a nice kiss.
Yeah.
And you're all happy and glowy. I'd like to dig into Ren's character development more in a second book and what her relationship with her dad was to her. I don't know how appropriate that would be for the type of book that this is. It's not going for that, but it did set up that dynamic.
Yeah, it did, yeah.
So that's why I feel like it's okay to wish for that to actually be paid off and explored rather than just, again, glossed over a little bit. Which felt like a waste of a really interesting and slightly dark family relationship. Also, let's just get some more magic in there. There was some good magic in Sweet and Bitter Magic, don't get me wrong, but I want to know more about how it works. Do they have to say a spell or do they not have to say a spell? It was unclear. Yeah. Can things appear out of nothing, or you know, what are you giving in exchange for that? Let's get a little bit more clarity on that. So I think it would be fun. I'm not asking for like a massively thought out hard magic system, but just because there were some interesting things about the way the magic happened in Sweet and Bitter Magic, and I think it would be nice to see the author build on that a bit more within the same world. So yeah, that would be my wish list for a book two, if there was going to be one, but there isn't.
You never know. You never, never know.
I guess.
But that's it for the book club episode. Thank you so, so much for listening. If you can't get enough of us, because obviously we're amazing, you can find us on Instagram at the Island Library Podcast.
You can follow us on Twitter at the Island Lib Pod.
You can also email in your book suggestions for us to tackle, either for the book club or just for our regular episodes at theislandlibrary@gmail.com. And you can find more information on our book club at www.theislandlibrary.com, and you click book club as you go on there and it will give you all the information and the book we're currently reading if you want to read along and join us.
Thank you so much to all of our listeners. We love you to bits. Thank you to our Patreon supporters and our book club members. You make this even more fun than it already would be. And thank you so much to Joe, because just love chatting with you. Happy days.
And I love chatting with you. Thank you so much for having me in your home. See you next time.
See you all next time. Bye. Bye. How much Pepsi Max am I going to need to see me through this?
All the Pepsi Max.